Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
Tonight on All In.
I witnessed insurgents beating police officers with fists, pipes, sticks, bats, metal barricades, and flagpoles. These criminals came prepared for war.
America's first real security hearing on the plot to attack our democracy includes a voyage to fantasyland.
Plainclothes militants, agents provocateurs, fake Trump protesters, and then disciplined, uniformed column of attackers.
Tonight, what we learned at the hearing with Senator Jeff Merkley, then how the Republican gun fetish is a staple of anti-government movements. Plus, Beto O'Rourke on the ongoing nightmare in Texas and what we now are learning about the condition of Tiger Woods after a horrible car accident this morning. And All In starts right now. Good evening from New York. I'm Chris Hayes. For most of today, as you might imagine, we have been following one breaking news story, the serious car accident involving golf legend Tiger Woods. According to officials, Woods was involved in a single vehicle rollover collision around 7 a.m. Pacific time. He was extracted from the wreck and taken to the hospital. At a press conference a little while ago, the Los Angeles County Sheriff said Woods was conscious when rescue workers arrived, and there is no evidence of impairment at this time. He said Woods may have been going at a greater speed than normal. There were no skid marks. The vehicle traveled several hundred feet, making contact with center median, went across opposing lanes, hit the curb, hit a tree, and the vehicle rolled over several times. Woods' agent said he suffered multiple leg injuries and was undergoing surgery. We're awaiting word on exactly how this happened. Obviously, we will keep you updated with any new details. The other major story of the day comes to us from Washington, D.C. We're 48 days since the insurrectionist attack on the Capitol that led to the death of three police officers. We had our first public accounting of the security preparations and failures on one of the most significant historical dates in modern American history. Until this point, we had heard nothing from the people responsible for defending the Capitol on that day. But today, the acting chief of the Metropolitan Police Department, former U.S. Capitol Police Chief, the former Senate Sergeant-at-Arms, and the former House Sergeant-at-Arms all testified before a joint Senate committee hearing. Those last three men all resigned following the attack. Coming into this hearing, we did not have consensus on the timeline of events or during the attack, and we do not have one still. We still do not know exactly what happened. Stephen Sund, who was the U.S. Capitol Police Chief during the attack, blamed former House Sergeant-at-Arms Paul Irving and former Senate Sergeant-at-Arms Michael Stenger for the sluggish response. Quote, I notified the two Sergeant-at-Arms by 1:09 p.m. I urgently needed support and asked them to declare a state of emergency and authorize the National Guard, Sun said. I was advised by Mr. Irving that he needed to run it up the chain of command. Now, Irving pushed back against Sun's account, saying he did not recall speaking to him at that time, had no record of any phone calls or text messages from Sun, and never said he had to run Sun's request up the chain of command. Instead of reaching an agreement about what went wrong so we can stop something like this from happening again, those men were apparently quite focused on saving what is left of their reputations after this catastrophic failure we all watched on national television. And speaking of reputation saving, Senator Ted Cruz, fresh off that now notorious and probably not that relaxing trip to Cancun, who led the push in the Senate to overturn Joe Biden's election, to deny him the seating of electors, and voted to do that even after the attack, had this to say about preventable behavior.
This hearing is nonetheless productive for analyzing the security decisions and law enforcement decisions that were made real time and for learning from them what can be done differently to ensure that an attack like that never again occurs.
Yes, Senator, we're all trying to figure out who is responsible for this so it never happens again. His colleague, Josh Hawley, who was the first sitting senator to announce formally that he would object to certifying the Electoral College votes, therefore making that day a big day, a point of interest, right? The last possible stand for the Trumpists. The senator who infamously raised his fist in salute to the crowd the day they stormed the Capitol. He was outraged today when a reporter asked if perhaps he was complicit in this attack.
Senator, what do you say to your fellow senators and to Americans who believe that you are complicit in this attack?
That's outrageous. I would say it's absolutely outrageous and an utter lie. And no one, I think, who knows any of the facts alleges any such thing.
I mean, actually, I'm one of the people who knows the facts. Lots of people who know the facts do allege precisely that, Senator. In fact, the idea that either of those men, Cruz and Hawley, who not only pushed the big lie the election was illegitimate, but actively acted to overturn the election democratic process, who made January 6th the big showdown day where they could do it, where they could stop Joe Biden from becoming president. The fact they were allowed to participate in the hearing is what strikes many as truly outrageous. Wisconsin Senator Ron Johnson did vote to certify Biden's election, but he has also been one of the chief spreaders of conspiracy theories around the election and attack on the Capitol. He did not hold back today, my word, reading a fact-free right-wing blog entry into the congressional record.
A very few didn't share the jovial, friendly, earnest demeanor of the great majority. Some obviously didn't fit in, and he describes four different types of people: plainclothes militants, agents provocateurs, fake Trump protesters, and then disciplined, uniformed column of attackers. I think these are the people that probably planned this.
Fake Trump protesters. Senator Johnson says agents provocateurs and fake Trump protesters, among others, are responsible for the attack. After all the evidence we have seen in the literally hundreds of charging documents. Someone should show Senator Johnson the charging document of, for instance, this alleged insurrectionist, Jose Padilla, who was charged with felony counts of obstruction of law enforcement and assault on a law enforcement officer with a deadly or dangerous weapon, and who allegedly wrote on Facebook, quote, "There's a lot of memes and posts flying around saying the people who were fighting last night were Antifa provocateurs, etc. I just want to say that as a firsthand observer of every point of last night, that it was not Antifa. They were patriots who were trying to restore the republic after being attacked by the cops who struck first. Even those who broke the windows next to the doorway to the Capitol were patriots trying to find a way to turn the flanks of the cops." This is a consistent theme. Trump supporters who stormed the Capitol are really angry because Republican politicians and conservative media who are supposed to be supporting Trump and his righteous cause are giving credit for all their hard work to Antifa. The lie that Trump and his supporters are not responsible for the attack, it's already canon in much of the GOP. You see it in the polling. I mean, get this. Trump himself tried this lie out as the attack was happening in a phone call with House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy, as a Republican Congresswoman Jamie Herrera Butler recalled. Quote, "When McCarthy finally reached the president on January 6th and asked him to publicly and forcefully call off the riot, the president initially repeated the falsehood that it was Antifa that had breached the Capitol. McCarthy refuted that and told the president these were Trump supporters. That's when, according to McCarthy, the president said, well, Kevin, I guess these people are more upset about the election than you are." He goes right from, they're not my people, to, well, maybe you should listen to them. You know, in 1951, political philosopher Hannah Arendt wrote in her now famous book, The Origins of Totalitarianism, quote, "In an ever-changing and comprehensible world, the masses had reached the point where they would, at the same time, believe everything and nothing, think that everything was possible and that nothing was true." And the profoundness of the cynicism is sort of the point of the totalitarian subject. Oh, it's Antifa. No, it's patriots. No, it's Antifa. Who knows? But for a Trump supporter to look at a sea of people in MAGA gear and Trump hats and be like, yes, that's Antifa, that's concerning. But to have a U.S. senator who is on the committee charged with overseeing the security of the Capitol pushing that lie, while two others who were part and parcel of why that day happened act shocked they could be accused of such things, that is illustrative of the broader state of one of the two major parties in this country. Democratic Senator Jeff Merkley participated in today's hearing on the January 6th insurrection. He joins me now. No cutaway cameras at this committee hearing, but what is it like as a fellow senator to read into the record this nonsense, this lie about who was responsible when everyone who was around knows who did it?
Chris, you know, we had this powerful opportunity to finally hear from some of the key managers of Capitol Security, the chief of police, the sergeant at arms of the Senate and the House, and then have these colleagues try to turn this hearing into let's perpetuate the big myth, the big myth that this had nothing to do with interrupting the vote to prevent Trump from failing to become president of the United States, to make sure that Joe Biden didn't become president. It's astounding. And it shows the challenge we have in America, where social media and cable television can get stories out in kind of the Trump bubble, media bubble, that is so hard to break into.
Have Josh Hawley or Ted Cruz ever apologized for what they did on that day?
Absolutely not. Not to my knowledge. If they've whispered an apology in anyone's ears, it certainly isn't something shared in the Senate community.
What is it like to have them there as he's sort of ostensibly disinterested, judges in a hearing or investigators, as it were, when, you know, that date became that date. It became the site of this, you know, largely because of Trump, but partly because those senators announced they were going to make it a contest. They were going to force these votes. They were going to draw it out and they were going to fight. And that's what the crowd wanted them to do.
You know, it had echoes of the impeachment trial, because there we had the Senate as jurors, but some of the jurors were folks who had perpetuated the big lie, led the effort to have other senators join them in it. And there they were today in the same hearing room, kind of continuing to provide the cover story as if they had no involvement or engagement. And it's just kind of, this is like an asteroid arriving from outer space rather than something that they had participated in. Trying to prevent the peaceful transition of power to a duly elected president. So it's a very strange and haunting moment. Something I could never have imagined as a, you know, growing up in Oregon and thinking about how the different branches of government worked to make checks and balances on each other and people of integrity and competency proceeding. Could never have imagined this happening here. And we just have to keep pushing back and trying to put adults back in charge.
I felt somewhat frustrated by today's hearing because I feel like I don't actually have that much clearer of a picture. There's obviously a fair amount of blame shifting and score settling, and it's a complicated situation. And, you know, I'm not really in a great position to sort of second guess the judgments of these individuals. It's not my area of expertise. But did you have the same feeling that we didn't actually we left with not a ton of clarity?
No, absolutely. The basic message that the group of them were presenting was an intelligence failure. We were thinking this would be like the million MAGA march in November and the second one in December, and we didn't have any indication it'd be any different. And those didn't become violent when they were in front of the Supreme Court, so why would this one become violent? And second of all, that when they reached out to get approval from the Pentagon to send the National Guard, the Pentagon slow walked it. And so those were the two main messages that they were conveying. But here's the thing. There was an FBI report the day before reporting on far-right extremists saying this is the moment to stop Joe Biden from being elected and ensure Trump will be elected, that we will fight to the death to make that happen, that there will be blood on the ground, that we must smash windows and smash doors. And that intelligence, when I asked the chief of the Capitol Police, did that get into your hands? He said, no, it was delivered to a sergeant who delivered it to our intelligence unit, but it never got to me. You would think a manager, the head of the team, would say, I'm supposed to make sure that the channels of communication for important facts get to me so we can make strategic decisions. And that didn't happen. And that's on me because I was in charge. But there was no sense of any of these individuals saying, yeah, I should have done better. We should have drilled. We should on different strategies where we didn't drill. We should have had more training. We should have had equipment at a previous point in time. Very little sense that any of these individuals were accepting responsibility for mistakes.
And also points to my mind, the need for some larger commission of inquiry, because the timeline of the Pentagon, the National Guard is still unclear. We have reports about several officers who've been suspended for possible actions that had that day. Again, none of this is in one place with information that we know, and I think we all need to see it. Senator Jeff Merkley, who is on that committee and in that hearing today, thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. Did you happen to see this the other day, this image? This is what it looked like when freshman Republican Congresswoman Lauren Boebert just zoomed into a committee hearing the other day. That is not a standard Zoom background behind her. That's custom made. That's actually her background. Do you notice something different in the bookshelves? Not just a stockpile of weapons sitting behind her. There is a deeper meaning to this image. And an implicit threat, too. I'll explain right after this. Stick around.
Hey, everyone. It's Ted from Consumer Cellular, the guy in the orange sweater. And this is your wake-up call. If you're paying too much for wireless service, you don't have to keep having that nightmare. Consumer Cellular has the same fast, reliable coverage as the leading carriers for less. And for a limited time, new customers receive their second month free when they sign up and use promo code MONTHFREE by May 31st. So why keep spending more than you have to? Seriously, wake up and call 1-888-FREEDOM or visit ConsumerCellular.com.
Taxes, fees, and other third-party charges will apply. See website for additional details.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
It's been unclear for some time what exactly it is that Donald Trump Jr. does, but like his father, he does love to make content. This week, he posted a video of himself ranting about teachers' unions while pointedly standing in front of a wall of guns. The whole thing had a "here are my thoughts from my bunker" vibe. But as weird as this image is, it's kind of becoming a trend on the right. Republican Congresswoman Lauren Boebert, owner of Shooter's Grill in Rifle, Colorado, where guns are welcome and seemingly encouraged on the premises, has built her political identity around guns. Boebert vowed to carry a Glock around D.C. and on Capitol Hill. She released a video to make sure that we all knew it. Last Thursday, she zoomed into a virtual congressional hearing with just a mess of guns piled on the bookshelf behind her. AR-15-style rifles, a handgun just laying across a bunch of books. Boebert, who is raising four young boys, later tweeted that the guns are not in storage, but are, quote, ready for use. Apparently, she just leaves them out because she fears she may need to fire multiple rounds of ammo into someone who comes into her den. You know, lots of people immediately noted that the use of guns in that way as props and the implicit threat that comes with them has a, you know, long, not necessarily great history among various movements around the globe. Osama bin Laden, for one, liked to pose in front of a bookshelf with a gun prominently displayed. The Irish Republican Army would display guns in its propaganda posters and its murals. Cuban revolutionaries, they posed with guns all the time, too. And no single side of the spectrum has a monopoly on this aesthetic. I mean, you can see it, you know, all over the world. It is unquestionably the aesthetic of armed struggle, of revolution or insurrection. A movement or faction that puts images of guns, the celebration of guns, front and center in its political aesthetic is a movement that's engaging in something other than what we might call the normal rhetoric of elected Democratic politics. You can't escape the meaning of it. It communicates that they're committed to, or at the very least, open to the possibility of violent overthrow of the government or the existing order. And now in the Republican Party, it seems like it's becoming common and unremarkable. You'll remember Marjorie Taylor Greene posed with this gun in her campaign ads next to Democratic members of Congress. She wears a mask reading Molon Labe, which is ancient Greek for come and take them in the halls of Congress. And that's been used for a bunch of reasons. But in her case, the implied message seems to be, if you try to take away our guns, we'll start shooting. Over decades, the right has built up this entire ideology around the Second Amendment, rooted in, frankly, the ridiculous idea that the U.S. government itself denied itself a monopoly on legitimate use of force because the founders had gone through revolution themselves. And the history just doesn't bear that out. It's not true. Not now and not during, for instance, the Whiskey Rebellion way back in 1794 when President George Washington got into his old uniform and got on a horse and sent in troops to violently suppress a violent tax protest. Many Republicans are now signaling they retain the right to use violence to overthrow the government at any time, that that's actually the core of part of their political principles in the Second Amendment. And they are willing to brandish that claim as a threat in pursuit of their political aims. And it's not some academic thing, right? I mean, right now, the threat of violence and menace hangs over our collective political life. From the armed protests in the Michigan State House last spring, which included men who, the FBI says, plotted to kidnap and kill the Democratic governor, to the violent insurrectionists on January 6th, some of whom vowed to kill any lawmakers who wouldn't do their bidding. It's become increasingly standard for the most hardcore devotees of Trump and his faction to at the very least wink at the notion that they're ready to hurt anyone who gets in their way. Sometimes the threat is all too real. Here's one example. Last year, an anti-feminist attorney who described himself as a Trump volunteer murdered the son of a federal judge, Esther Salas, nearly killed her husband using a gun. Salas was the target. The killer has also been tracking Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor.
You know, we were screaming, Daniel, hold on, and don't leave us. And then I just, as I think about that day, I realized I was watching my only child fade away.
Shannon Watts is the founder of Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America, staunch critic of the way some Republicans use guns for political gain. With me is David Jolly. He used to be a Republican member of Congress from Florida, and he left the party back in 2018. Shannon, you know, politicians will often, through my life as a political reporter, pose with guns in different ways. John Kerry in a duck blind and Joe Manchin shooting a bill. And, you know, there's a certain, you know, a lot of Americans really like guns. They cherish owning them for sport. There seems to be a different thing happening in that Lauren Boebert pose that says something different, it's communicating something different. What do you think it's doing?
You know, it's intimidation, pure and simple, right? I mean, that's the point of having these guns behind them. They're not saying, you know, we are here to demonstrate our freedom. They are there to threaten our freedom. And that's particularly alarming given that just a month ago, we had armed insurrectionists storm the Capitol and they had enough live ammunition to shoot every member of the House and Senate five times. So this has nothing to do with self-defense. You know, this is a dangerous trend that really started on the internet years ago. I mean, you may remember you had Moms Demand Action volunteers on your show in 2014 who were having lunch and these armed men in Texas pulled guns out of their cars and sort of tried to intimidate them while they were having lunch. And it was an international story. And now that behavior has become mainstream in many ways because of the NRA. You know, it is at worst about owning the libs, and it is becoming more and more about causing a second civil war. And really, that's why passing stronger gun laws has never been more important.
Yeah, the sort of semiotics of it, the symbolism, the meaning of it, David, to me is just really inescapable. It's like, I think the people who are really into guns are like, well, this is just a thing that I love, right? This is my hobby, or this is this object that I think is super cool. And so, you know, it's protected by the First Amendment, it's an expression of my political identity. But it's like, if you show up at my kid's Little League game and you just happen to be sporting the gun you really like, we're all freaking out. You can't separate the two.
Look, I'd say it's more dire than even that. The danger that we're seeing among today's Republicans, the examples you just gave, is the direct correlation between the imagery and a target. Right? Donald Trump Jr. talking about teachers' unions. Marjorie Taylor Greene with her imagery of the squad as she's holding the automatic weapon. With Laura Boebert, it's this defense against the big government. And January 6th, we saw a willingness to tackle that government. That's where the danger of the Republican Party moving from a party of less government to one willing to undermine and kneecap and tackle the government while leaders of the Republican Party are embracing this imagery of the Second Amendment. That's where it's so dangerous, because that gets us to a world in which the Oklahoma City bombing happened. And right. Chris, there's two major deceits that Republicans practice. The first is they conflate fundamental rights with absolute rights. Laura Boebert did that in her rant before the Natural Resources Committee. She suggested that owning guns and taking them into the Capitol is an absolute right. That's not the case. All of our fundamental rights have certain restrictions, including the Second Amendment, including the First with speech, religion, and so forth. The second deceit Republicans practice is they know that there's no legislation that would pass the House and be signed by President Biden that would take away gun ownership from law-abiding, rightful citizens, their ability to right. own guns. And so they reframe it around this issue of freedom, that Democrats want to take your freedom. And that is a powerful drug that they're peddling in this imagery that they're presenting.
Right. And then there's this there's this sort of ideology there, too, which we saw in the Michigan. We saw it in Richmond. Right. Richmond, to me, was part of the beginning of this. That's when thousands and thousands of gun owners converged from the Capitol with their guns. Right. And again, it's like it's a protest and it's nonviolent. But when thousands of people with guns converge in a Capitol, that sends a certain message. And Shannon, that, you know, it feels to me like it's gone from like we like guns because we're into hunting or target practice to I need it for self-defense to no, I actually want to retain the right to overthrow the government violently. And that seems like a more and more mainstream idea at the core here.
Absolutely. You know, it is the logical outcome of allowing gun lobbyists to write our nation's gun laws for decades. Again, Moms Demand Action has been sounding the alarm on this. We would have marches and rallies and go to restaurants or stores and see people open carrying, which is largely unregulated in over 40 states in this country. And again, years ago, when I started doing this, the NRA called open carry downright weird. And then they changed their mind and they started to support it. And really, the NRA has led us to this moment, right? They never miss a moment to say the sky is falling and the only way to stay safe is to shoot at it. And because at the end of the day, this is, again, not about self-defense. This is about enriching gun manufacturers and gun lobbyists. And for too long, they have had so much sway over our lawmakers and our laws.
David, there's a polling that shows 39% of Republicans considering that political violence can be justified. Now, of course, context for that, you know, you can argue that there are some circumstances, the Warsaw Ghetto, for instance, where it's justified. But that's a pretty high number. And you know, we're also just living in the aftermath of like a big act of political violence in the Capitol to try to stop the peaceful transfer of power.
Chris, this is the real life danger of where the Republican Party is today. The first step in justifying violence is delegitimizing your victim. Yeah. And by Republicans suggesting that the government is not legitimate, that the elections are not legitimate, it more easily justifies violence by people who would consider taking this into their own hands through the use of firearms. That is the danger with which Republicans are flirting.
Shannon Watts and David Jolly, that was a great discussion. Thank you both for your time.
Thank you.
All right. All right, coming up, in the face of a statewide emergency, you might remember Texas Senator Ted Cruz hopped on a plane to Mexico. Beto O'Rourke, on the other hand, got to work. And Beto joins me next.
Hey, everyone. It's Ted from Consumer Cellular, the guy in the orange sweater, and this is your wake-up call. If you're paying too much for wireless service, you don't have to keep having that nightmare. Consumer Cellular has the same fast, reliable coverage as the leading carriers for less. And for a limited time, new customers receive their second month free when they sign up and use promo code MONTHFREE by May 31st. So why keep spending more than you have to? Seriously, wake up and call 1-888-FREEDOM or visit ConsumerCellular.com.
Taxes, fees, and other third-party charges will apply. See website for additional details.
Just 1 week after the Texas electrical grid, known as ERCOT, failed and left millions of Texans without power during a freezing winter storm, a full third of ERCOT's board handed in their resignations. Not one of them actually lives in Texas, by the way. And while people literally froze to death in the dark last week, Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton traveled to Utah to talk about an antitrust lawsuit against Google. Senator Ted Cruz dipped to Cancun with his family before being shamed into cutting his trip short. He flew back on Thursday. As he flew back on Thursday, New York Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez launched a fundraising drive for Texas. Within 2 hours of announcing her fundraising efforts, she'd pulled in $325,000 in donations. Days later, she was on the ground in Houston, volunteering with some of her Texas colleagues in the House and ultimately raising $5 million. Former Texas Congressman Beto O'Rourke has also been stepping up to help his fellow Texans. His organization, Powered by People, has raised over $1 million. He's been going door to door, checking in on folks, helping connect them to various resources. And Beto O'Rourke joins me now. First, I just wanted to get a sense from you of how things are there. I know the weather got a lot warmer. Power came back. A bunch of people still with water issues or water damage. What's it look like there?
So, Chris, tonight I'm in the Rio Grande Valley, and I was in an unincorporated community called Hargill. It's about 1,000 residents there. They lost power for 4 days. Luckily, they have that back on now, but they're still under a boil water notice, which means they cannot drink what comes out of the tap. So along with other volunteers, we were distributing water there. Folks are recovering. They're getting their lives back to normal. but they are deeply frustrated, as are millions of Texans across the state. We've been to San Antonio, Austin, up to the rural part of North Texas in Raines County, where it's 8 days and counting now, where some communities still do not have water. And I think everyone understands this is not a natural disaster. It is a man-made one. And the men who made it are still in power and have yet to be held accountable for it. And folks want answers.
Yeah, you could feel, you know, in my conversations with Texans through last week, this kind of dual sense of, I got to bear down and get through this and figure out a way to not have my pipes explode all over my house and make sure my elders are, you know, warm. But like a rising rage coming up in everyone's throats, really across a political spectrum of like, how in God's name is this the situation in Texas?
It's interesting. We were in a small community called Point, Texas, in Raines County in the northern part of the state yesterday. And I think it's, you know, pretty reliably red. In fact, one of the people who volunteered with us had a Trump Make America Great Again mask on as we were distributing water. But it's interesting. His dad lives on a property that doesn't have running water anymore because of the power outage and the failure of the local water utility. And they're drawing water from the pond on their property to drink. And he said, I used to be concerned about COVID. Now I'm concerned about cholera. Hmm. And this is happening in the 21st century, in the wealthiest country on the face of the planet, in the energy capital of North America. A government has completely failed us. You know, more than 10 years of deregulation, decisions made not to weatherize or provide for excess capacity or connect us to the rest of the electrical grid has left people out and on their own and has accounted for at least 30 deaths just in the greater Houston area. And as you know, an 11-year-old boy who died in his trailer home, an 8-year-old girl who died next to her mother of carbon monoxide poisoning, and many other deaths, and probably many more than we will ever know about. And none of them had to happen. And as you said at the introduction, you know, folks want to blame ERCOT or think that if the board members resign, then this issue is over. It is not. That the folks who made these decisions are still in power, and we need to make new decisions and perhaps potentially have new people in those positions of public trust to make them if we're not going to have this again, especially considering that weather events like this, because of climate change, are going to become more frequent, more severe, and unfortunately, they're going to be deadlier going forward. We have to change course.
What do you see as the fallout politically? I mean, you're saying there's anger and that this isn't just about ERCOT. There are policy decisions made at the state level. What does that look like? And how do you ensure that this isn't one of those things where people kind of quickly forget about it and move on to other things?
I think because of the great reporting that you're seeing in Texas and by national outlets such as yourself, folks are connecting the dots. They recognize that Governor Abbott appoints to the Public Utility Commission that has the regulatory oversight responsibility and power when it comes to ERCOT. They realize that every member of the Texas Railroad Commission, which regulates not railroads, but the oil and gas and energy industry in Texas, have responsibility for the development and transmission of our energy resources that were completely stalled out over the course of this storm. And people want answers and they want accountability and they want to know that this is not going to happen to them again. You know, the worst part about this, of course, has been the loss of life. But you mentioned the broken pipes, which have then produced, you know, flooding in people's homes, mold on their drywall that has to be pulled out. So far, the most expensive storm in Texas history. And then to add insult to injury, you have ratepayers who signed up for variable pricing electricity plans, who got bills for $17,000, a school teacher with a $10,000 1 month electricity bill that is in no way her fault. And she should not have to pay it. That's up to the state government that failed her.
Well, that seems like a layup for Texas politicians of any ideological stripe. We should note the president is going down to Houston on Friday to survey the aftermath. Former Texas Congressman Beto O'Rourke in the Rio Grande Valley. Thanks for making some time for us tonight.
Thanks, Chris.
Ahead, the cancel culture wars are so important to Republicans. It is the theme of this year's CPAC, America Uncanceled. So it sure would be a shame if they had to cancel a speaker after uncovering some old tweets, wouldn't it? Yeah, that's next. Half a million Americans dead from the pandemic and millions still out of work and hungry. Conservatives have focused in on the biggest problem facing America, cancel culture.
We understand it. We understand their cancel culture. We're not letting them cancel culture us at all.
Do you have a functioning First Amendment when the cancel culture only allows one side to talk?
We're witnessing the cancel culture purge being kicked into overdrive here.
Cancel culture is a real thing. It is very real.
This cancel culture is so dangerous, and we have to push back. This is the number one issue for the country to address today.
The number one issue for the country to address today. He said that like a week ago. The menace of cancel culture is so important, it's felt so intensely, that the whole theme of this year's Conservative CPAC conference, the premier event for American conservatism, is America Uncanceled. Of course, the definition of cancel culture has always been really slippery. I mean, almost every workplace, organization, political party, or even conference of conservative activists has some lines about what kinds of speech it thinks are acceptable and what kinds just aren't. Mostly conservatives are mad that non-conservatives are drawing lines that they just don't agree with. You can probably see where this is going. How long do you think it took the America Uncanceled conference to themselves cancel someone? CPAC posted this tweet at 4:18 p.m. yesterday. We have just learned that someone we invited to CPAC has expressed reprehensible views that have no home with our conference or our organization. The individual will not be participating at our conference. And with the canceled speaker going unnamed there, that could have referred to, well, any number of CPAC speakers who have expressed reprehensible views. That's sort of the whole point of CPAC. It turns out the America Uncanceled organizers canceled a rapper named Young Pharoah. This is him on the archived version of CPAC's page, pushing to his social media, which contains posts saying Judaism is not real, along with anti-Semitic views. Young Pharoah had been scheduled to speak on Sunday afternoon, just 1 hour before CPAC's keynote speaker, a man who was canceled by the voters of America, who reportedly said he would only appear if his former vice president didn't. Young Pharoah's comments were too reprehensible for CPAC, but the man who helped, whose words helped incite an insurrection at the Capitol, he gets the keynote. When we come back, as we pass 500,000 lives lost to the pandemic, a look at how many might still be with us if it weren't for the failures of President Trump. That's next. Tonight, congressional leaders gathered on the steps of the Capitol to commemorate the half million Americans who have now died from COVID-19. Even though cases are now trending down, we're still losing over 1,000 people per day on a weekly average, 2,000 just recorded today. And it's always worth remembering, important to remember, it did not have to be this way. To choose two examples, the U.S. and South Korea, for example, both recorded their first official COVID cases on the same day at the end of January last year. South Korea immediately rolled out large-scale testing and contact tracing and strong messaging en masse. The U.S. did not. Here's a chart showing new deaths attributed to COVID since the pandemic began. The blue line is the United States, deaths soaring, peaking throughout the year, and the pink line is the bottom is South Korea. If the U.S. had followed the same trajectory as South Korea, if we had the same number of deaths per capita, we would have lost about 10,000 Americans instead of 500,000. And while it was impossible to truly know how many Americans would have been saved if the previous administration had taken the pandemic seriously, it's pretty clear their actions caused irreparable harm.
The people who wanted to deny that this is something that was serious, when you get a signal from above that it might not be, then you don't do the kinds of things you need to do. I mean, I still have flashing in my mind those scenes of when we were trying to tell people to really be careful and avoid congregate settings, and used to see on television at night people crowded at bars, inside, no masks. I mean, that was just asking for trouble. And in fact, that's what we got, a lot of trouble.
Now, to President Joe Biden, of course, trying to undo the damage to bring the pandemic to a close by vaccinating the population, but just basically doing everything the last administration didn't, like, you know, setting an example and wearing a mask, asking Americans to social distance, not listening to junk science.
I think there's a growing awareness that, injecting bleach into your system doesn't do it for you. And I'm being, you know, I mean, think about all the ridiculous things. And there is online still, there are those who are the vaccine
deniers.
Yeah. And telling all these stories about that aren't true.
It's going to take a lot to change the trajectory that has unfolded in America over the past year. To hear talk about what went so wrong, what needs to be done to make it right, one of the members of Joe Biden's transition COVID-19 Advisory Board, President and Executive Director of the Global Health Council, Lois Pace. It's great to have you. We talked about South Korea in the intro, but South Korea was A-plus student, right? They did what they had one of the best responses in the world. And in fact, throughout the Pacific, across governments and with different forums and institutions, Vietnam, Singapore, Taiwan, Hong Kong, China, Japan, South Korea, Australia, New Zealand, they all did a really good job. But even if you compare us to the European Union or Canada, where do we stack up? Where is the U.S. in our response if you just look at these sort of Atlantic countries?
Yeah, no, Chris, I can appreciate the laundry list of countries that really were ahead of us in their own response. And I think it's important to step back and not just look at the 500, the milestone that we hit yesterday with 500,000 deaths, which is just heartbreaking and infuriating. But even just think about what that means in the scope of the rest of the world, right? The U.S. actually is taking up or counting for 20% of global deaths and 25% of cases. That makes no sense given we aren't even 5% of the world's population. And so in addition to the countries you mentioned, you know, you do have a host of others that have demonstrated, frankly, that leadership matters, right? And that it's critically important that no matter what you know, you have to do right by the people you're serving. And that's frankly what we didn't see in this past year with this pandemic.
How much should we think about this? I mean, there's a few things that make America exceptional, distinct here, right? So one is Donald Trump was president. Then there's the nature of America's general baseline health and particularly health inequities that were there before Donald Trump. And then there's the degree to which America's public health infrastructure is not that good. Like, where do you apportion those different points of blame?
Yeah, no, I wonder if we spread the blame sort of equally across each of those, because this certainly was a problem before 2020 when the pandemic was upon us. We know that health disparities were a thing, regardless of what happened in the past year. And so you're absolutely right. Our solution has to be focused not only on correcting the mistakes or placing any blame. We have to really go back and really dig deeply into the roots of this very problem and understand how it turned out, how we ended up with rates of hospitalization and deaths 2 and 3 times that in certain communities, particularly in Black, Brown, and Indigenous communities, that's unconscionable. And we see that trend actually worldwide where Black and Brown folk are suffering and struggling with the impact of this.
Well, I just want to ask you though, is that a sociological factor or is that a policy leadership fact, right? Like
I think it's absolutely tied to policy. We know that public health is of course scientifically based on its own in its own right, but we are powerless without the policy, right? and without political leadership.
I guess I mean, do you think it's policy specific to the US COVID response? Or broader, I mean, you know what I mean? Like, I agree with you, it's clearly policy, right? We make choices to have racial inequities in this country. We make them every day. But those racial inequities and the fact that they put people on the front line in so many ways, whether it was the work they had to do or the comorbidities that were produced by the environments in which they lived and the access to healthcare they had before, or if it was like the guy at the top was saying injecting bleach was the solution and telling people to get out there like they were warriors.
Yeah, no, I think it's both and, not either or. It's really hard to choose one or the other. And the leadership or the lack thereof was not helpful. Let's be clear, right? We really needed our government and people from the very top on down to step up. And I'm grateful, frankly, for the career staff and others who really held the line, who really ensured that people still had correct information, because myths and misinformation are a very real thing that we're fighting against now. And it's harder to catch up when all of that is out there. It's also critical that now there's a plan for not just vaccine distribution, right, but testing and tracing. This is what other countries did right as well. You had even the UK, which struggled in its response, frankly, when these variants emerged. The fact that they were actually able to identify them,
right,
and address them is critical. And that those are the types of systems we didn't already have in place before now, and we're just playing catch up.
Right. And those systems, I mean, I think that we're going to hopefully get to a point where we have vaccination suppression, you know, at some point this summer. But we know it's seasonal, and there will be, you know, next fall and winter, there'll be ways in which we have to battle it. And we're going to need those systems in place then, particularly.
Absolutely. And I would even say, you know, we don't really quite understand the virus fully to know that we have even that long to wait. And
right,
so that's why
we're
still saying it's critically important to practice those public health measures, regardless of where we are in the calendar or even in our trajectory with vaccines, because it's changing before our eyes. And particularly until we can catch up, it's going to continue to beat us.
Yeah, that's an important point. And I don't want to, like, we got to just hold on. It's like the end of a car ride where you've been fine for the 9 hours. And now the last 10, 15, 20 minutes just seem unbearable. And I think a lot of people are in that mental state, but with just a certain amount of consistent messaging and discipline we all need.
Yeah, no, and I understand that people are tired too, right? I mean, I do this for a living and I am exhausted, not just because of getting up every day trying to fight this thing, but because I too miss my friends and family, and I too wish this were all over, and it just isn't. And unfortunately, we do have a ways to go. I have faith that we can continue to stand strong and understand that we've made it through tough times before, frankly, as a country. I think we pride ourselves on that, and I know it sounds rather cliche, but that's what I'm standing on right now.
Lois Pace, thank you so much for making time. Come on back. That does it for All In. You can catch us every weeknight at 8 o'clock on MSNBC. Don't forget to like us on Facebook. That's facebook.com/allinwithchris.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.